I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. On November 19, 1863, 150 years ago today, President Lincoln delivered a short speech in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, at the dedication for the Soldiers' National Cemetery. This was just a few months after a brutal battle that left thousands dead in a civil war that would rage on for another year and a half. Even though he was not the featured speaker that day, Lincoln's words have lived on and continue to inspire, in spite of his prediction that they would be forgotten. Today on Radio Times, the Gettysburg Address, then and now. We are joined by two historians. Sean Wilentz is a historian and the George Henry Davis 1886 Professor of American History at Princeton University, the author of several books, including 360 Sound, The Columbia Record Story, Bob Dylan in America, and The Rise of American Democracy, Jefferson to Lincoln. Sean Wilentz, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
As ever, Marty. Great to be here.
Nice to have you with us. Also with us, Alan Gelzo, and he's the Henry R. Luce Professor of the Civil War Era, Director of Civil War Era Studies at Gettysburg College, author most recently of a book called Gettysburg, The Last Invasion. His other books include Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation and American Lincoln, Abraham Lincoln, Redeemer President. I have to slow down here. Alan Gelzo, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Very nice to be here again, and happy Gettysburg Address Day.
Indeed, this is Gettysburg Address Day. And for any questions or comments, do give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Alan, do you think the brevity of this address is part of its greatness?
That's certainly one of the central aspects of the thing. Not only is it short, it's 270 words, more or less. And that means that it's easily listened to, easily memorized, and therefore can be assimilated by people very readily. But it's also remarkable for the fact that those 270-odd words are themselves very short, very pithy, very direct words. Of those words, 190 of them are single-syllable words. Hmm. So that what comes across in the Gettysburg Address is a very direct, unadorned impact. You can listen to this and understand every word, every direction. There's nothing in it which hangs out banners or which is pointing to itself and is displaying itself.
How do you read this speech?
Well, the brevity is part of it. To be able to distill the purpose of the war in the middle of the war, all of the purposes, not just the ones that were on people's minds at that moment, equality, the Union, holding the Union together, but I think the unstated, often unstated aim, which is about democracy, and how this war was to settle the question of whether democracy could survive, not just American democracy, but democracy full stop. And he managed to put that together. I mean, this and the second inaugural, I think, are his greatest speeches, but this has that brevity, that simplicity. It's a complex issue, but it's a very simple matter, as he put it.
And at that time, in 1863, was there any other democracy besides the United States in the world?
Well, nothing quite like it. There were those in Latin America and so forth, but everyone looked to the United States, and the United States was the first great one. France had failed. All the revolutions in Europe were all failing. It all failed in 1848. So America was the beacon for those who hoped for democracy, but it was also the example to those monarchs and aristocrats around the world who wanted democracy to fail, and they were looking upon us very, very closely.
And Alan, is this a typical Abraham Lincoln speech? And by that, I mean when you talk about the simplicity of the language, even the monosyllabic words, was that typical for Lincoln?
I think very much so, because Lincoln was carving out a niche for himself in a complex of ways of speaking in public in the middle of the 19th century. There was at the very top of that heap what you can call classical speech, which is the kind of three-decker, ship of the line, full of Italianate resonance and Latinate.
Very rococo.
Highly inflected language, full of classical allusions. All right, that's at the very top. At the very bottom, of course, is just kind of folk speech, vernacular speech, and there's also technical speech. But sandwiched in between there is what you can call middling speech. That's the speech of lawyers, of newspapers, popular preachers. And Lincoln really carves out that niche for himself and makes that a vehicle for public communication. I think in a lot of ways the Gettysburg Address almost single-handedly overthrows the dominance of classical speech and makes that middling speech the most important way that Americans have of communicating with each other in public.
You even call this a public sermon.
In a fashion, yes, because the pattern of this has an echo in it of the old Puritan Jeremiad, where you begin by looking at the past and what was expected there, by the present, when everything seems to have had all the wheels going off, and the future, which, despite the problems in the present, has nevertheless the promise of something that is going to happen, which is good, which is going to be a fulfillment of the original promise in the past. And that's very much like what you'd get from New England preachers in the 17th century, but probably also still very similar to what Lincoln himself heard as a boy on the frontier.
And who was his audience? Who do you think he was speaking to? Obviously, there was the audience in front of him, mm-hmm. in Gettysburg. But was there a larger audience that he was trying to speak to as well?
Well, yes. I mean, understand, presidents didn't give many speeches in the 19th century. You know, this was not something they did all the time. Even the State of the Union, all of that didn't happen. So whenever a president addressed the public, it was an important event, which people took notice of, and certainly the speech they took notice of, even though it was only meant to be a few remarks. So I think that, yes, I think very much that Lincoln is certainly speaking beyond the confines of what's happening. He knows it's going to be printed. He knows it's going to be out there, that people are going to be reading it, if not listening to it. So he's speaking to the entire nation. He's speaking to a nation that is, you know, the battle had been won at Gettysburg, but the war was going on, to try to improve morale or keep morale up, to point out to the nation, or point out to the North and the South, what this war was all about. And that was a very, very important function for him as a leader. I also think, I mean, I don't know how much Lincoln had his eye cocked to posterity, but this is a speech that I think, you know, if anything, is a speech that would live on. And if democracy was going to live, then this speech would live.
But he sort of says, and maybe he's just being modest here, I mean, that those who fought here, they in a sense, their
Absolutely.
Memory will live on, but will these words?
Absolutely. But what he's doing is taking their sacrifice and giving and explaining the meaning of it in a way that might not have been self-evident. But understand, yes, this is a graveyard. He's a massive graveyard. There are dead bodies, not dead long, in the ground. So he's very, very aware of that, the importance of all of that.
Was he also speaking to the South, Alan?
Not nearly as directly. He is speaking to the North. He's speaking to people who have, lost some wind in this war, because for the previous 2 years of the war, the fate of the Union had not been a very promising one. Armies, especially in the Eastern Theater, have been reeling from one defeat to another, and Gettysburg was an important hinge moment. It really meant the reversal of the tide of affairs, and from this point on, the fate of the Confederacy would spiral on downwards. For Lincoln, this is actually a very optimistic statement, because he's able to look at the situation now in the fall of 1863 and really begin to think, well, this is going to turn out all right after all. And I think there is, in a lot of ways, although this is a speech, as Sean says, in a graveyard, this is actually a very optimistic speech, because it's saying that those who died here did not die in vain, and from them we can take this renewed dedication, and we can go forward to government of the people, by the people, and for the people.
Is the word slavery does not appear in this speech, Sean, but is it embedded in the speech? And
sure.
And he signed the Emancipation Proclamation earlier in 1863.
January 1st, 1863.
Right.
The new birth of freedom is I think, the central phrase here. The Emancipation Proclamation did not win universal assent in the North, and in putting that line in, making it clear that this war was now, that the Union Army was now an army of liberation, in effect, or not in effect, it was, that was a central part of what they had died for. But it's not the only thing he's talking about. He's talking about other things as well. He's embedding that as in the center of this larger goal.
But the idea is to hold this country together. I mean, that the Union must prevail.
Well, but that's also about democracy. And remember that this war had begun because of a presidential election. I mean, the reason that the South seceded was because Abraham Lincoln was elected president. He was elected democratically, according to the Constitution, as he says in his first inaugural. You know, I'm here because I won. The South seceded. That was a direct blow to democracy, to the idea of popular sovereignty, to the idea of constitutional government. He called it the essence of anarchy. So this is a point that's been there all along, really, and he's reformulating it here.
You want to add to that, Alan?
Lincoln said in May of 1861 that the real nub of the meaning of the Civil War was whether ordinary people could govern themselves, whether democracy would actually work. Because if one group of people, the moment they hit a major political roadblock with each other, if they decide that, well, you know, we didn't get our way, we're going to take our bat and ball and go someplace else, that's not democracy. That is the essence of anarchy. And the war is really going to be a test as to whether citizens in a democracy are really fit to give that kind of shape, that kind of oversight, and to preserve that democracy. And if they can't, he said, that's going to go a long way towards demonstrating that ordinary people, the consent of the governed, really doesn't work, that you can't trust people, and what we really need are the aristocrats and the monarchs to come in, to step in and do the job for us.
And what was the reaction to the speech at the time? You were actually saying, Alan, that at the time it was being, I guess, transcribed 19th century style and perhaps changed as it was sent across the country.
Well, there are many ways the speech is received. First of all, it's by the people there. And there is a legend out there that the Gettysburg Address fell as flat as a wall on the people who heard it, and no one really understood what was going on. That is, again, that's a legend. And it's a legend that pays a backhanded compliment to the address, because what it's really trying to do is to say that Lincoln was so profound that nobody standing there at the moment could really understand
it. Oh, that's interesting.
So it's a backhanded tribute there. But in reality, the people who stood there listening really understood they had heard an enormously important statement. Pennsylvania Governor Andrew Curtin was sitting on the platform behind Lincoln, and Curtin said the intensity with which people listened to Lincoln speaking was really amazing. And Curtin wrote, "My God, it was so impressive." People interrupted even this short 2.5-minute speech 5 times with what one observer called vociferous applause. And at the very end, they set up 3 cheers for Lincoln. So it was well-received there, and it's well-received across the country, except among the most die-hard Lincolnites, who would have found fault if Lincoln had gotten up and recited Mary Had a Little Lamb.
Well, the Harrisburg Patriot and Union at the time called this Lincoln's silly remarks. Apparently, the paper, which has a different name today, has amended that.
Yes, they officially retracted it.
They officially did, 150 years later. But yeah, go ahead, John.
Well, I mean, look, there are a lot of Democrats still around. There are Democratic newspapers. Lincoln gets the reputation falsely for having been a tyrant for closing down newspapers. There's plenty of Democratic newspapers out there who, if he had gone up and recited the Democratic platform, they would have found something to object to. And that's part of the situation of the war then. I mean, we're coming into an election year the following year. Lincoln knows that they're going to have an election, which is extraordinary enough. But then the question is, how is he going to fare? And it's by no means clear that he is going to win that election.
Mm. And we're going to take a very short break and get back to our conversation. That's Sean Wilentz, history professor at Princeton University. In fact, he's speaking today at noon at the National Constitution Center about the Gettysburg Address. Also with us, Alan Gelzo, and he's a professor at Gettysburg College, and he's speaking at McCormick Hall at Princeton University today at 4:30. Lots of talk today about the Gettysburg Address. And again, any questions or comments you might have, give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. We'll be right back.
Live Nation supports WHYY and welcomes alternative rockers Arcade Fire to Philadelphia March 17th at Wells Fargo Center. American Express presale now through Thursday. Tickets for general public available Friday. Tickets at ComcastTix.com or Wells Fargo Center box office.
Do you recall the first time you met John Kennedy?
Yes, I do.
I told him, I said, "Mr. Kennedy," he says, "look, my name is Jack. You call me Jack."
And there he was, the President of the United States, standing on the doorstep.
I'm Robert McNeil, and the program is We Knew JFK, Unheard Stories from the Kennedy Archives, from the Public Radio Exchange.
God, I hope they don't play this for a long, long time.
Friday night at 10 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Next time on Here and Now, in his new memoir, The Death of Santini, best-selling author Pat Conroy mines his powerful family history yet again.
No writer has been imprisoned by his family like I have in the history of American letters. I have been writing about this family for 40 years.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Many of the main lines supports WHYY, featuring the full line of the fuel-efficient, design-for-fun Mini. Located less than 5 miles from the Philadelphia Art Museum at 130 Montgomery Avenue in Bala-Cynwyd, and online at minimainline.com.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoway, and we are talking about Abraham Lincoln's Gettysburg Address, delivered 150 years ago today. And our guests are historians Sean Valence from Princeton University, Alan Gelzo from Gettysburg College. And again, we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me just pull out a sentence or two here, and just picking up on what you both said. Lincoln says, "Now we are engaged in a great civil war, testing whether that nation or any nation so conceived and so dedicated can long endure." So at that time, Sean, he was worried about the country falling apart, or even if the North was winning the civil war, what was the future of this country at that time?
Yes, and the question is what the nation is conceived in, and it's conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Can such a nation survive? Not just our nation, any nation. This goes to the point that Alan was making earlier. It's not specific. It's beyond democracy here. He's talking about liberty, yes, but he's also talking about equality. And he's talking about the Declaration of Independence.
Right.
Can such a nation anywhere survive? And that's what's being tested here.
You see that way, Alan?
I think the question, it really is this overall problem of democracy. Is democracy a workable entity? Is it a way that people can govern themselves? In 1776, it looked like democracy was going to be the coming thing, that the United States had separated from Great Britain, it was establishing itself as a republic. Then in 1789, we get the French Revolution, that looks like the beachhead of the American Revolution. But then after that, it all spirals downwards, and it goes through the things that Sean was talking about. It goes through the Reign of Terror, through the tyranny of Napoleon Bonaparte, and then the repression in the years following 1815. And it gets to the point where it looks like democracy is a great idea in theory, but will never actually work in practice, because it's got this centrifugal problem. It's always spinning its own pieces off into the air. And Lincoln is saying, well, this is the test. This is the final exam for democracy. Is what is happening in the American Civil War the last and final proof that democracy just doesn't work? It's just too inherently unstable. So he says, this is the test. We're going to see if we pass this. What's the evidence? Those who are buried here. And that's not just for the United States. That's democracy anywhere.
It's for everywhere.
Because if democracy goes down in the United States, if it goes down, especially if it goes down in a civil war, in other words, where we do it to ourselves, if it goes down here, it's not going to get up and walk anyplace else.
Go ahead, John.
And the Civil War is an important part of it because, the Southerners consider themselves Democrats as well. They have their own version of democracy, a slaveholder's democracy. So the Civil War and putting equality in there, he's also slipping in the idea that out of the Civil War, a particular kind of democracy will emerge, a democracy that is dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. That is not the democracy of the South. And so it's in some ways it's reminding people what happened and why we're having this war. It's not only a war to preserve democracy, it's a war over what democracy should be.
But it sounds like this is still an issue today in other countries where we have civil wars and fights over democracy and equality and all the hallmarks that we think of as a democracy.
But understand, this is the first. I think Alan, it's absolutely right. I mean, this is America is alone in the world. So this is the test. We know that democracies can survive now as a result of what happened. Right. We didn't know then.
It is as though we assume today that democracy is kind of a baseline, that it's kind of a default position, that everybody really wants to be in a democracy. That wasn't by any means the case in 1863. And there are many places in the world today where it's by no means the case either, where there are all kinds of regimes which look at democracy and says, well, that's just a figment of the Western imagination. That's just a failed example of the way Westerners do things. And those kinds of voices are not only in remote places, there are plenty of people today, even in elite circles, who are really suffering from what you can call democracy fatigue. You know, they really don't have a whole lot of confidence in this democracy thing, because democracy is a place where you take all the people who are concentrating on nothing but being fat, dumb, and happy, and all that they're interested in is their self-promotion and their well-being. How can you possibly see anything noble or transcendent in that? I mean, just go to your local school board at its next meeting. And you'll see some examples of ordinary people behaving in extremely ordinary fashion. So the reputation of democracy, it reminds me of E.M. Forster's essays, Two Cheers for Democracy. And there's still a great deal of that, not only in places far, far away, but even at home. Again, democracy fatigue.
Do you think these words inspired the Union soldiers, Sean? I mean, did it trickle down to them on the battlefield?
Well, it's funny. At the beginning of Steven Spielberg's film, there are a couple of soldiers quoting from, one black, one white, as I recall. I don't know that it would have had quite that effect. I don't know. Alan, you could answer this question better than I, whether the soldiers were actually given copies of this. Were they reading it? I don't know that they were.
Well, they weren't exactly given copies of it, but they were reading it because soldiers are already quoting from the Gettysburg Address in diaries and letters in 1864. In fact, the speech itself is being anthologized in elocution textbooks by the end of 1864, like Beadle's Dime Orator. And this is already becoming a model for people to use for public speaking. So it's no surprise at all, in my mind at least, that in the Spielberg movie, you will have, at the very beginning, soldiers who are able to quote the Gettysburg Address. Of course, I remember, too, that the first set of those soldiers trying to quote it didn't get it right.
That's quite correct.
They couldn't remember enough of it to finish it. But that, unfortunately, tends to be a problem whenever you encounter students.
Yes, indeed. But do you think, Sean, this is a short speech, obviously, about 270 words, that what he doesn't say is also important?
Well, what do you mean?
Well, I'm not even sure what I mean, but there was so much he could have said.
He could have talked about slavery.
He could have talked about slavery.
At length, sure.
Yeah, and he could have talked about the Constitution.
Right,
yeah.
Or the Confederacy.
Or Congress, or the opposition. I mean, in September of 1863, he writes a very lengthy public letter, which is entirely addressed to Democratic opposition in the North, in which he orally interrogates them. You know, are you for this? Are you for that? You should be supporting the Union. He doesn't do any of that. And sometimes people look at this and say, well, because slavery is not talked about in here, or the Constitution is not talked about in the Gettysburg Address, that means that Lincoln wasn't interested in slavery, he didn't see slavery as the real issue in the Civil War, or he really is trying to outmaneuver the Constitution, or something like that. And I think that misses a point that Sean made, and that is that all of those issues, slavery, the Constitution, all of those are really included in this overall umbrella about the survival of democracy. Because, look, if democracy does not survive, if the Union embracing and exemplifying that democracy does not survive, you're never going to get to deal with slavery, and the Constitution is going to be a dead letter anyway. So those are really all subsumed in what he is saying here in these 270-odd words.
Well, I'm thinking about a president trying to heal, Sean, I guess, the wounds of you know, a pretty horrific war that had raged on for a couple of years by then.
Yeah, I mean, it's, well, the war's outcome was hardly known at this point, and it's going to get worse. By 1864, if it hadn't been, in fact, for Sherman in Atlanta, it's entirely possible at the end of 1864, it's entirely possible that Lincoln would not have been elected. In his place would have been General George McClellan, who would have sued for a separate peace with the South, and we would have had perhaps a nation, but slavery would certainly have still been there.
Wow.
So these are all, I mean, this is not by any means a victory speech. This is a speech to inspire. This is a speech to carry on against some very, very long odds. Not all of them in the South. Not all of them the Confederacy.
Hard to imagine a President McClellan.
Actually, in some respects, no, not too difficult, because he was a very popular general.
Mm-hmm.
His record today, we look back on and we kind of chuckle over and we say he was a general who was always getting ready for a battle but was never able to do it.
And that was Lincoln's frustration with him.
Lincoln said about McClellan one time that McClellan was an extremely talented engineer when it came to a stationary engine. and And for exactly that reason, McClellan has this inflated reputation, and it's entirely possible that a President McClellan could be thinkable, and if he did, in fact, win the presidency, Sean's right. His next step or two would have been to have opened negotiations with the Confederacy. Once the negotiations start and the fighting stops, you're not going to get the fighting restarted. That's going to put the upper hand to the Confederates, and they're going to get what they want, which really is independence. And if they do, understand that the Confederacy, when you step back and look at it as an independent nation, if it ever was that, is actually the fourth largest industrial nation in the world at that time. I mean, it's not hugely industrialized, but compared to the others, it's number four. Imagine a Confederacy bent upon extending its control over Cuba, over the Caribbean, over Mexico into South America. The North could have been sealed off into a kind of Scandinavian irrelevance, and the Confederacy might have emerged as the major North American power.
And slavery would have lasted well into the 20th century.
Exactly.
Into the 20th century.
Exactly. And there's no real. People often say, well, slavery was dying out. No, it wasn't. It was very successful.
People see the South expanding to the West, because that was the West was the issue in the political issue that led to the war, right? But the South had its. The Confederates had their eyes on the South. That is to say, the Caribbean, Mexico, that whole empire that they could build, where slavery already existed anyway. But getting back for a second to the question of what the address left out.
Yes.
And this question of slavery. I find it frustrating when anyone can say that Abraham Lincoln was not a sincere enemy of slavery for a lot of reasons. But it's right here in the Gettysburg Address as well. It's not said, but it's said with economy, but it's said directly. He has said, basically at the beginning, that 47 years ago, a country was founded based on liberty and equality. Now, at the very end of the speech, he talks about a new birth of freedom. We are going to take off from that. We're going to expand upon that. The only thing he can mean is slavery.
Hmm.
That is what he's talking about. So it's there.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you, just so our listeners know who's talking. That's Sean Wilentz. He's a history professor at Princeton University. Also with us, Alan Gelzo, a history professor at Gettysburg College. And we are talking about the Gettysburg Address, the Civil War, President Lincoln. And any questions or comments, again, give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. Alan, you wanted to add something.
That new birth phrase sticks out very prominently. And Sean's right to put the focus on it. What's really interesting is how much resonance it had beyond just saying, well, we're going to do something new, a new departure, a new leaf. He really means something more than that. Because that phrase, new birth, in the context of early 19th century American culture, that's religious revival.
That's right.
What he is talking about here is something that would have all the impact of a major spiritual rebirth of the American democracy. And when he says new birth, all the ears prick up. They know what that means.
And he says that this nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom, that the government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth. Sean, it also sounds like he's saying we have to win this war.
Oh, well, absolutely. I mean, the stakes were enormous.
And the curious thing is that it is the ordinary soldiers on whom he puts so much focus in this speech. You know, he doesn't say anything about Governor Curtin or about David Wills or any of the people who organized this thing. There's no shout out there. He puts all the focus on the soldiers, those brave men living and dead who struggled here. And the truth is that long term, it's those same soldiers who are going to make the Gettysburg Address what it is in our minds today. Because if Sherman hadn't taken Atlanta, if Grant hadn't taken Richmond, if Lincoln had not been reelected, then all of this really would have been for nothing. And we'd look back on the Gettysburg Address as a curiosity, a political puff piece, the same way we might look upon the inaugural address of Jefferson Davis.
Right.
And he says, but in a larger sense, we cannot dedicate, we cannot consecrate, we cannot hallow this ground. The brave men living and dead who struggled here have consecrated far above our poor power to add or detract. I mean, this is a beautiful piece of writing there.
It's beautifully written, and it's making the that's the part of the speech which is about the occasion of the day.
Right.
And he is trying to say that these men who have made the supreme sacrifice, they are the people that we have to honor here. We cannot do anything beyond what they have done. They have given the ultimate sacrifice. Then he moves on. He makes that point, but then he moves on. He makes it beautifully. I do like the idea, though, that the rebirth of the new birth of freedom is, in fact, a born-again America.
Under God.
Well, under God. He doesn't say that. It's a secular thing. He's not putting it that way, but people would have understood it in that context. And what that means is, basically, that one America has died, an old soul has died, and another one has been born. And that is really what the Civil War in the end is all about, in any case. It's just that he wanted to make sure that the democracy rather than slaveocracy succeeded.
Alan, I was reading the couple of versions of the Gettysburg Address. Some included the word God and some didn't. Is that true?
Well, there are five versions of this in Lincoln's own hand. Two of those versions do not include the phrase under God. One of those versions is the so-called Nicolay copy, which in all likelihood is actually the copy he was using on the platform. But don't make too much of that, because he actually made a number of interpolations into that copy as he was delivering the speech. There's an element of impromptu, by the way, that goes into this. We think this is already carved into stone somewhere. It's not. Lincoln is ad-libbing at some points. And we know that he's ad-libbing because the Associated Press reporters were taking this down in shorthand, and they record his insertion of under God. The other three versions of this that he writes out, he also includes specifically under God and puts that into those handwritten versions.
So he's editing as he goes?
He's editing as he goes, but he wants to make sure that people know, I really did say that, I intended to say that, and that's what was said on the platform. Mm-hmm.
Do we know what his voice sounded like, John?
Well, we've heard descriptions of Daniel Day-Lewis does not do a bad job, in my estimation, in the film. A somewhat high, reedy voice, not given to natural elocution. He had to learn how to throw his voice. You know, there's no microphones in these days.
Right.
And so during the Lincoln-Douglas debates, about which Alan has written brilliantly, one of the things was he had to make sure he was going to be heard at the farthest reach to this huge crowd. He trained himself how to do that.
Wow.
He trained himself how to do that because he didn't have a naturally booming or resonant voice.
So he just...
Unlike Edward Everett, I suspect.
And we should say Everett Everett was the
he was the
lead speaker.
He was the marquee name because he was one of the most famous orators in the country.
Wow.
He had probably done more than anyone else through his orations about Washington to save Mount Vernon. Now, the occasions in which he spoke, he raised money for Mount Vernon. He'd been the president of Harvard. He'd been the Eliot Professor of Greek Literature. He'd been a U.S. senator, a congressman, governor of Massachusetts. He had the glittering resume. And when people come to Gettysburg, Everett is a major draw. And it was not a mistake to put him in that place where he's going to deliver this 2.5-hour review of the entire Civil War and the entire Battle of Gettysburg. Nobody, on those terms at least, could have done it better than Edward Everett. And yet Everett says to Lincoln afterwards, if I could have said in my 2.5 hours what you said in your 2.5 minutes, I would be a very happy man indeed.
Yeah.
Well, let's take another short break, and we do have some callers who want to join us at 1-888-477-9499. We are talking about the Gettysburg Address, delivered 150 years ago today, if you can believe it. Sean Malenza, history professor at Princeton University. He'll be speaking at the National Constitution Center today at noon. Alan Gelzo is a historian at Gettysburg College, and he'll be speaking at Princeton University this afternoon at McCormick Hall at 4:30. And we're taking calls, as I said, at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. We'll be right back.
Phoebe Wincoat supports WHYY. Phoebe Wincoat, a community of Phoebe Ministries, provides independent living apartments just minutes from Philadelphia. Phoebe Wincoat offers maintenance-free living with close proximity to cultural and education opportunities. Short-term rehab and personal care are also provided, enabling you to age in place as independently as possible. Information can be found at phoebe.org/wincoat or to arrange a personal tour, 215-461-2102.
On the next Fresh Air, Angelica Houston, who became famous for her roles in Pritzi's Honor and The Grifters, and more recently co-starred in Smash. Her new memoir is about her formative years. Her father was the celebrated director John Houston, but when she was a teenager and he directed her in a film, it scared her away from acting for a while and she became a model. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Seven score and 10 years ago. That's how long since Abe Lincoln delivered the Gettysburg Address.
This is an ongoing experiment. We've got to keep renewing the promise of America from generation to generation.
Independent Senator Angus King on Gettysburg and whether a divided nation is still standing. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking about the Gettysburg Address, which is being talked about probably across the country today. If you want to join the conversation, but you can't call in, you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times or at Marty Moss-Cohen. And again, you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Sean, you wanted to correct some misunderstandings about the Gettysburg Address. It was not written on the back of an envelope.
Yes.
Let's take care of some of the myths about the address. That's one of them.
That's probably the most famous myth, that Lincoln wrote the Gettysburg Address on the back of an envelope as he's on the train going to Gettysburg. Let's put a stake right through the heart of that, okay? Lincoln already had a full text of this worked out before he left Washington. When he gets to Gettysburg, he's going to make some changes. He's going to do some editorial work that evening and even the morning of the Gettysburg dedication ceremonies because he's one of these finicky editors of his own writing. Uh-huh. He can never let the thing alone. He'd be the despair of an op-ed editor in a newspaper today. But he does not write it on the train, and there's no evidence that he writes it on the back of an envelope. That story began with almost an offhand reference in an 1866 biography when someone talked about, well, he saw Lincoln writing something on the train. Well, yes, well, he could have been writing his laundry list. It's not until 1906 when Mary Shipman Andrews writes a famous short story called The Perfect Tribute that this story of Lincoln writing the Gettysburg Address on the back of an envelope blossoms in full. But it's a fictional short story. Nevertheless, it takes on a life of its own, and I always ask in a room, how many people were told the story that Lincoln wrote the address on the back of an envelope? And 9 out of 10 people put their hands up. It's still out there.
But what's interesting, meaning that he just sort of knocked it off and that he didn't think about what he was saying. So.
Right. Well, that's another backhanded tribute. Right. See, it's like it comes to him as divine inspiration.
A bad lesson for students, however. You don't want them to just write their assignments on the back of an envelope as they're coming into class. Not a good idea.
We actually have a email comment from Charles from Germantown. He was wondering whether the Haitian Revolution in any way influenced Lincoln's thinking about democracy. And John, I don't know if you've looked at that or if you feel like that's...
The Haitian Revolution was there. It was a great example of a slave insurrection that succeeded. So insofar as it's part of the history of slavery and anti-slavery, that is part of the mix. But the Haitian Revolution had also failed. It looked as if things had gone backwards. It was part of, in fact, what Alan was talking about earlier, that series of events at the end of the 18th century, beginning of the 19th century, which did not end happily. Now, Lincoln was going to extend recognition. He was going to. This is the first Black Republic, so in that sense, the Haitian Revolution is very important to marking out where Lincoln's going to be. When I say it failed, what I'm saying the country didn't fail, but it had not come up to its full promise.
Let me get. Looks like David from Yardley to join our conversation. David, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty.
Hi.
Thanks
there.
For taking my call.
You're welcome.
I was wondering if your guest could talk a little bit about how Lincoln felt about the need to keep the country together, and if he talked about that or if he was addressing it in the address, in view of the fact that, from the Southern perspective, they voted to leave the Union. So it's sort of interesting to say, you know, it's a democratic country, the United States, yet here's a segment of the country that wanted to get out and felt like they had a right to get out.
It's something we touched earlier, David. It's a good question, and Alan, I'll toss that back to you.
Well, democracy is not an opportunity to take votes to break agreements. and to void contracts. The Constitution has no reversion clause in it. When states ratified the Constitution, that was a permanent deed. That was a permanent commitment. You might, just might, be able to make some kind of argument about the legitimacy of withdrawing from the Union, let's say 6 months after ratifying the Constitution. You think, oh, that was a bad idea. But look, we're now on to 1863. This pretense that the Constitution is just a friendly club, that it's an association of independent nations that can be withdrawn from at will, this is an absurdity in cultural and in political terms. So that when people offer this excuse, well, we're seceding from the Union. Well, there is no such thing as secession. Huh. There's no description in the Constitution how to secede from the Union. There's no instruction booklet. This is what you do, X, Y, and Z, when you want to secede from the Union. The Constitution, simply by the very nature of the Constitution itself, is a permanent arrangement. We are Americans. We're not just Virginians or Pennsylvanians or New Jerseyans or even South Jerseyans. We are all part of a nation, and that had been established really beyond any serious question by 1863.
Sure. I mean, as Andrew Jackson said 30 years earlier, the American government is a government, not a league. It's not a compact association. Indeed, in many respects, the nation precedes the states. I mean, we've been talking about the United Colonies of America from 1774 on. The beginning of the Constitution is to form a more perfect union.
Mm.
It's not the beginning of anything. Mm. It's not the start of something. It's something that's already existed.
Lincoln makes exactly that argument when he says, when you look at the Articles of Confederation, which preceded the Constitution, the Articles of Confederation actually explicitly make that union perpetual.
Correct.
Now, Lincoln argues when the Constitution supersedes the Articles to make a more perfect union, do you think they were actually regressing from that?
Huh.
They were receding from that? And Lincoln is simply pointing out, secession is not an exercise of democracy, any more than democracy can be defined as two wolves and a lamb taking a vote on what to have for dinner. That's not democracy either. What the South was doing was the denial of democracy, and at virtually every level.
Mm. I mean, there were those in the South during the crisis who made actually the same point, who didn't want to go along with the secessionists. I mean, not all the Southerners were secessionists. Many thought that the political as well as the social interests of the South would be much better served if the South stayed in the Union rather than to secede. So this idea that the South is unified, is just doing its own thing, is incorrect too. The vast majority of Americans, in fact, understood exactly what Alan's talking about.
But what's interesting, and I guess maybe this comes with a democracy, there's secession talk today. I mean, you hear of
alas,
of counties sometimes, even states talking secession.
Well, we can go into this in another time, but I think there has been a resurgence, if you will, of a political idea, the political ideas that really stem from John C. Calhoun more than anyone else.
Huh.
The idea of the Union not being perpetual, of the states having the right to void laws. You also hear about this. We're going to void federal laws within our borders. This is an idea that Jackson, the great nationalist tradition in American politics, which is the great tradition in American politics, going from Jackson to Lincoln to Grant on to LBJ and others, they have established that that is the tradition, and that Calhoun is bunk.
I think
it's worth noting, too, that Calhoun is also a major figure denying the equality that is talked about in the Declaration of Independence. In fact, saying, quite frankly, that the Declaration of Independence was a big mistake.
Right.
Let me get, looks like Jose from Burlington County to join our conversation. Jose, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Good morning.
You're bringing thoughts to my mind as if the document is a living document. The struggles that it mentions, the hollow ground that it mentions, are struggles that are going on today in challenging democracy. The depth of the document really is a contemporary living document, and today it seems that it reminds us that democracy is at risk all the time. It's evolving, it's moving forward, and the risks that are engaged in or described in the document are still current. They're ongoing.
Well, I appreciate the call to Radio Times, and I think, Jose, a reminder about this living document, but also the risks to democracy, or perhaps even built into a democracy, Alan.
Democracy has a risk that is internal and a risk that is external. The external was the one that most Americans were concerned about because the British Empire was still there on our northern border in the form of Canada. The French, in their effort to create a new French Empire in North America, had installed a puppet ruler in Mexico. When people looked around, they saw the first threat to democracy as being one coming from other countries, from Renaissance monarchies and empires. But Lincoln also saw there was a threat from the inside. One of his very first political speeches in 1838 said, "The American experiment is going to experience its greatest threat, not from outside invasion." Armies, even armies under Napoleon, can invade us, but they won't succeed. It's not going to work that way. The real threat is going to come from within, from a spirit of lawlessness, a spirit of selfishness, a spirit of contempt for others. When you put those things in place and you give them public rostrums to speak from, that is what will really be the threat to democracy. So the real enemy to democracy that Lincoln most feared, even in the 1830s, was, as he said, that the United States would die by suicide, not by outside threat.
Go ahead, John.
Yeah, I mean, that very speech, in fact, took off from an incident in St. Louis, where a black man had been basically lynched, for want of a better term, which led to an incident where the first abolitionist martyr, Elijah Lovejoy, was killed. He is seeing this reaction against anti-slavery. He's not an abolitionist, but he is certainly defends their right to say what they're going to say. He sees this lawlessness everywhere, in a lot of places by 1838. The Confederacy, in effect, to him, I believe, is the kind of the ne plus ultra or the summation of that lawlessness. I mean, he sees that very, very clearly. It's all kind of led to this. It's come to this. And that's why, in the first inaugural, he's as strong about all of that as he is.
Let me get, looks like Denise from Princeton to join us on Radio Times. And Denise, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my question.
You're welcome.
Which goes more towards the conspiracy than your issue. But I just wanted to ask speakers their insight. Gore Vidal's book on Lincoln, it is a fictional version, he suggests that David Harold may have been attempting to poison Lincoln because he did fall sick in the aftermath of the Gettysburg Address. And I wanted to know if they had any thoughts that may have been possible, if that could have happened.
Well, Denise, let's find out. I'm tossing that over to you, Alan.
When Lincoln leaves Gettysburg in the evening of November 19th to go back to Washington, he actually lays down for a large part of the way with a wet cloth over his forehead. This is because he's coming down with what was known as varioloid, which is a non-lethal form of smallpox, a milder form of smallpox. Still get the pustules, you still get the misery and the discomfort, but you're not going to die of varioloid. And this is what afflicts Lincoln for, 2 to 3 weeks after he gets back to Washington. He actually has the cabinet come into his bedroom and meet there. Mm. This is when he tells them, "At last I have something I can give to everyone."
And, is that true?
Yeah.
That's that Lincoln humor, right?
Because people have always been besieging him for office appointments and whatnot. Yeah. So he does come down with that. But it would be very difficult for me to know how David Harold or anyone else could have bottled that up and snuck it into Lincoln. For him to come down with. That is simply one of the hazards of 19th century public health, which was lethal quite frequently and miserable at best.
Sean, let me ask you about how you see Lincoln's, I guess, political skills. I mean, Lincoln as a politician, not necessarily as a president, but how do you see, and obviously in a very difficult time with the Civil War.
Well, there's no being a president without being a politician, and he understood that, unlike some presidents. Look, I mean, if Abraham Lincoln was filling out a passport, they didn't have passports in those days, they asked occupation, that would be what he'd write down,
politician,
because that's what he was from the very beginning. That's what he did, not simply as an office holder, but as the head of the Whig Party in Illinois. He was a real inside political operator. It's unfortunate. People these days, Americans generally, actually, when you say the word politics or politician, very often, lingering there in their minds is the word dirty.
Yeah, that's right.
Politics is necessarily dirty. That it goes to some of the things that Alan was talking about. It's full of selfishness. The sordid side of democracy is all that politics is. Well, Abraham Lincoln was a very shrewd politician. He knew how to handle many, many different people in many, many different ways, play people off against each other. He was a consummate politician. But dirty? No.
You agree with that, Alan?
I do, and I think that the skill that Lincoln shows is paid tribute to by his opponents. Even within his own political party, one of his bitterest critics, Benjamin Wade of Ohio, criticized what he called Lincoln's backstairs way of dealing with Congress. Well, in a way, that was actually something of a tribute, because what it meant was that Lincoln knew how to work the machinery, and he knew how to do it without being clumsy, without doing it in public where everybody could see mistakes being made. He knew how to do it in a very subtle fashion and get what he wanted done. Mm-hmm. He actually kept a carriage and horses always ready at the White House to send his two aides, John Hay and John George Nicolay, to Capitol Hill with messages. He wouldn't go himself. Presidents in those days did not go to Capitol Hill. That the only times in which he actually is in the Capitol building is for his inauguration and for a handful of other special occasions. Huh. That was almost a no-go zone. Congress defended its privileges quite vociferously. But he had a way of getting his message in there, of also, conversely, bringing people down Pennsylvania Avenue, sitting them down, and doing some gentle twisting of the arm and making it clear what he wanted done. He really knew how to be a good politician without sacrificing principle or throwing principle to the winds.
I mean, one of the things about Lincoln's writing, actually, that throws many historians off is that almost everything he writes is deeply political in one way or another. And people mistake Lincoln. There's a famous letter that he writes to Horace Greeley in reply to something that Greeley had written. And he makes the point that he would free all the slaves that would win the war, or he would free none of the slaves that would win the war. People are taking to say that he had no particular interest in slavery. Wrong. Absolutely wrong. First, it's the first time that he mentions the fact that he might just free all the slaves. This is not not a small matter. But he's arguing against Greeley, not for slavery.
Mm. Well, we could go on, and my thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. I learned a lot. I appreciate that. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Marty.
Thank you, Marty.
And you can catch up with our guests. In fact, you can catch up with Sean Wilentz. He's part of the National Constitution Center's Town Hall Tuesdays, speaking at noon today. Alan Gelzo will be speaking at Princeton at McCormick Hall this afternoon at 4:30. Go to whyy.org/radio. Times to find out more about this program. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back.